Collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
Hi, my name is Taku. I want to say shout out to all the raccoons on campus. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on Burnaby.
Today on Wings, a memory from the UN Fourth World Conference on Women. Muslim feminist theologian Rifat Hassan tells how sexism crept into Islam.
If you will not take the challenge of religion and feminist theology seriously, there is no other way of liberating Muslim women.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
God created all human beings at the same time, in the same manner, no difference whatsoever. Now, if that be the case, why is it and how is it that virtually every Muslim that I have ever met believes that woman was created from the rib of Adam? Have they been reading Genesis? No, I don't think so.
The following remarks were made by Professor Rifat Hassan of the University of Louisville at the non-governmental forum of the United Nations Fourth World Conference on Women.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. My understanding of the task assigned to presenters in this plenary was to give a critical review or overview of strategies which may be used to counter the various forms of conservatism which are having a negative impact on significant numbers of women in the contemporary world. Since I have been engaged since 1974 in developing the discipline of feminist theology in the context of Islam, a few words about how I became involved in a task which has been so central to my life journey may be useful as an introduction to my research and reflections which I would like to share with you this morning. Experientially, I have always known what it means to be a Muslim woman. I come from a Sayyid Muslim family. Sayyids are the descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be on him. I come from Lahore, a historic Muslim city, which is in Pakistan, a country created in the name of Islam, so you cannot get much more Muslim than that. However, it was not until 1974 when I was teaching at Oklahoma State University in a place called Stillwater, Oklahoma, a place which lives up to its name, my career as a feminist theologian began almost accidentally and perhaps even against my will. As on many campuses across the United States, on this particular campus there was a chapter of what was known then as Muslim Student Association, which was the largest body of Muslim students in North America. It was the policy of this particular university that every student body or chapter had to have a faculty advisor, and that particular year I happened to be the only Muslim faculty member on campus. And so I became the advisor to this group that was extremely patriarchal in its orientation. It consisted almost entirely of Arab students from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, and they were not overly thrilled to have me as their faculty advisor. It was the tradition of this group that later in fall each year they had a seminar, an annual seminar, at which it was customary for the faculty advisor to make a presentation on the theme of the seminar. I was asked by the students to make a presentation on the subject of women in Islam. That was not the theme of the seminar. But I was asked to talk about that topic because they thought that, well, what else could she talk about, even though I was the professor of Islamic studies, but they didn't think I was competent to talk about anything else. I did understand the insinuation beneath the invitation and was a bit resentful. However, I accepted the invitation for two reasons. One was that this group was so patriarchal in its orientation, it did not allow women even in the audience. Many of these men had wives, but they were not allowed to be in the audience. And many of them felt that it was haram or impermissible for them to hear a woman's voice because it would put their soul in mortal jeopardy. So I said, well, that's good. At least they'll have to hear my voice. Secondly, I had come across so many articles, books and brochures, hundreds of them, on the topic of the status and role and position of women, Muslim women or women in Islam, virtually all of them by Muslim men. I had not come across a single publication on the subject of the role or status or position of man in Islam, and had come to feel perhaps that men didn't have any status or role or position. And my dream is one day perhaps to return the favor and allocate some sort of role to them. But anyhow, until such time as that happens, I thought that it would be interesting to reflect on this question from a woman's point of view. That's how this journey started. I had a pretty good idea of what the students expected me to say, and I wasn't going to say that. What was I going to say? I had used the Quran, which for Muslims is the primary source of Islam. Islam has, by the way, four sources which are ranked in a certain order. The highest of these sources is the Quran, which Muslims believe to be God's word, transmitted through the agency of Archangel Gabriel to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be on him, who then transmitted it to the Muslims. Then comes what is called the prophetic example, consisting of the hadith and the sunnah, the oral and the practical traditions of the Prophet. And then come ijma, which is consensus of the community, and ijtihad, which is independent reasoning. So basically, both ijma and ijtihad collectively represent the application of human reason. Anyhow, I used the Quran as a textbook in my courses on Islam, but I had not up till that time done a systematic study of the Quranic passages relating to women, which I started to do at that time. And that is when my life took an entirely different turn. Because the deeper I got into this study, the more angry I became. And I became very angry because of two reasons. One, because I began to perceive very clearly the discrepancy or the wide gulf between Quranic ideals or norms of what the Quran was saying about the rights of women and what was actually happening to Muslim women in various Muslim societies. And secondly, because I began to realize for the first time in my life how many things had happened to me personally because I had been born female in a Muslim society. Now, the anger that I felt then has stayed with me all through these years, though it has taken different forms. And as one of my colleagues said earlier, anger, I believe, can be a very constructive force for change. It depends on what you do with it. Since that time, since 1974, I have been engaged in this study. For me, this study has always been very deeply rooted existentially. It was not an academic study. It was never an academic study. And for about a period of 10 years between 1974 and about 1983-84, it was for me a very private study. I was doing it was sort of as an Odyssean venture in self-understanding, trying to understand my own life as a Muslim woman. But enlightenment does not always lead to endless bliss. That has not been my experience. I realized more and more how patriarchal the Islamic tradition had become. Unlike Catholicism, Islam had not always been conservative. The early centuries of Islam were characterized by tremendous cultural diversity, by the right of dissent, by openness to dialogue, and that is why the Muslims, during the first 300 years, were able to create not only the largest empire that has ever existed territorially, extending from Spain to India, but they had created a civilization which has been one of the greatest in the world in terms of its art, its architecture, its philosophy, its literature, its scientific achievements, and so on. So that there had been a different kind of a history in the early centuries of Islam. Also in early Islam, there had been many outstanding women, such as Khadija and Aisha, the wives of the Prophet, peace be on him, and Rabia, the most outstanding Sufi woman in an age of saints. However, after the first 300 years, when the so-called gates of ijtihad or independent inquiry were closed due to a variety of reasons that I cannot investigate at this point due to shortage of time, the Islamic tradition has remained rigidly patriarchal, and Muslim men have arrogated to themselves the task of defining the ontological, theological, sociological, and eschatological status of Muslim women. So this study of mine continued for about 10 years, until I went to Pakistan for a period of 2 years between 1983 and 84. Now, at this point, this country was undergoing a massive wave of what has come to be known as the Islamization process. And already in 1979, under the rule of General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq, the Hudud Ordinance had been passed, according to which, in all the Hud crimes, which include the crime of rape and murder, a woman's evidence is not admissible. So that a woman who was raped could not testify on her own behalf, and the only way that her evidence would become admissible would be if the crime was reduced from a Hud to a Tazir crime. Not only was this simply a matter of the passing of some laws, but in the wake of these laws, there was a tremendous wave of violence towards women and the appearance of anti-women literature all over the place. And there were many, many cases of brutality towards women. In response to all of these, a women's movement was born. In fact, for many years in that country under martial law, the women's movement was the only living thing that was happening. However, despite the fact that many of these women were very valiant and they fought in all the ways that they knew how to fight, held processions, they had rallies, they had press conferences, nonetheless, they were not able to reverse this sort of anti-women legislation. And some of them came to me at that time and asked me, because I had been engaged in this study, rather privately, but nevertheless people knew about it, or some people knew about it, to provide them with an ideology for their movement. Now for me, this was a tremendously important moment. It was a moment of history, because this study that I had done out of my personal passion or quest had acquired a political and social meaning that I could never have imagined. At this point, I had to rethink many things. One thing that I had been doing for 10 years had been to give alternative interpretations of the Quranic passages that had been used against women. And I could do that. That work had already been done. And this is what some of my feminist activist friends wanted me to do. However, the question that I became very interested in, that really began to intrigue me, was a larger and a more profound question. And the question was the following. The question was, how is it possible in Pakistan, which is a progressive Muslim country, for such archaic and unjust laws to be passed in 1983 and 84? How is it possible? As I reflected on this question, the answer that came to me with a stunning clarity was a very simple answer. But sometimes it takes us forever to see the simplest things. The answer was as follows. It is regarded as self-evident in all Muslim societies that men are superior to women and women are inferior to men. Men believe it and women believe it, so what's the problem about institutionalizing this belief in all kinds of laws? And this is what was happening. But then this is, of course, not the end of the question, because beliefs and ideas also have their history. So the question is, where did this idea that men are superior to women and women are inferior to men come from? And that was the question that I became interested in and that I began to investigate. And in investigating that, I expanded my field of study spent several months doing a very systematic and exhaustive study of the two most important hadith collections in Sunni Islam, namely Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, which are next in authority only to the Quran. I also made a rereading of many of the Christian feminist theologians like Phyllis Trible, Rosemary Ruther, and others who had done I think there's something wrong with your watch, because I started speaking at 7 minutes past 10. I know, I'm sorry. I'm watching the time. And thank you. I think Muslim women have had a very short shrift in this world anyway, so kindly allow me to finish. At the end of this period of study, I identified three theological assumptions that, in my judgment, underlie not only discrimination against women in the Islamic tradition, but also in the Jewish and Christian tradition. These three theological assumptions are as follows. Number one, that God's primary creation was Adam, that Adam was a male person, and that from the rib of this male person, God created Eve, who was a female person, and therefore Eve is secondary and derivative and subordinate. This is the issue of woman's creation. Number two, that though Eve was secondary in creation, she was primary in guilt in so far as the so-called fall episode was concerned, because she got poor Adam thrown out of paradise. We all know the story. And because of that, daughters of Eve are always to be treated with hatred, ridicule, and contempt. And there's a whole baggage of feminine evil and gullibility and weakness attached to this story. And the third theological assumption is that not only was woman created from Adam, but she was created for Adam, which makes her instrumental and makes him fundamental. Now, since 1984 to the present time, I have been working on these three myths, and I have, in fact, written a book on the first one, which is called Equal Before Allah? The issue of man-woman equality in terms of creation. Now, in order to show to you how feminist theology is effective and is perhaps the only way to bring about change in the Muslim world, I would like to take a few minutes to share with you some of the methodology that I have used in working out this issue. If one asks the average Muslim about the creation of woman, you know, you ask a simple question, how was woman created? The answer comes back without the blinking of an eye. The answer is from the rib of Adam. Now, what's wrong with this answer? There's something profoundly wrong with this answer. And what's wrong with this answer is as follows. This idea that God's primary creation was Adam and that the woman was created from the rib of Adam is not found in the Quran. There is, in fact, no Eve in the Quran at all. This idea comes from one of the two creation stories in the book of Genesis, which is the first book of the Bible. There are in the Bible two creation stories. There's one in chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, which is attributed to a writer called the priest. The story is dated the 5th century before the Christian era. And then there is a second story in chapter 2, which is attributed to another writer called the Yahvist. This is dated the 10th century before the Christian era. And this is a story that everybody in the world knows. And the story is, God created Adam, no suitable companion for Adam was to be found. So Adam was lonely, God put Adam to sleep, and while Adam slept, God created woman from the rib of Adam. And when Adam awoke, he was overjoyed, and he broke out into a song of celebration, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, thou art. And you all know the story. It is impossible for me to tell you the impact, the negative impact of the way that this story has been interpreted through 2,000 years of Christian history. From the time of St. Paul, who was the first formulator of the Christian tradition, who said in 1 Corinthians 11:3 to 9, he's talking about, he says, God is the head of Christ, Christ is the head of man, man is the head of woman. I do not allow a woman to pray or prophesy with her head uncovered. If she will not cover her head, she must shave off her head, which was a sign that you were a harlot in Israel. And that a woman must cover her head, but a man must not cover his head, for a man is made in the image of God and reflects God's glory, but a woman is made in the image of man and reflects man's glory. And the clinching argument is, for woman came from man, not man from woman. Woman is responsible for the fall, and woman was created for the sake of man, or not the other way around. So what has happened here is there's been a creation of a hierarchy. God, Christ, man, woman. Woman is always at the bottom. Now, again, due to shortage of time, I cannot share with you the historical development of this idea, but it runs like a refrain through the Christian tradition, and it was also then taken into the Jewish tradition and the Islamic tradition. If you look at the Quranic accounts of human creation, there are 30 creation stories in the Quran, not one, but 30. The Quran, of course, is not structured like the Bible. It's not chronological. It's not historical. So it's more like wisdom literature. It has different accounts. But in none of these 30 accounts of creation is there any mention of a male creation first and a female creation second. In all of these 30 passages, what you have are three generic terms for humanity: An-Nas, Al-Bashr, and Al-Insan. So what these 30 creation stories are saying is that God created all human beings at the same time, in the same manner, no difference whatsoever. Now, if that be the case, why is it and how is it that virtually every Muslim that I have ever met believes that woman was created from the rib of Adam? Have they been reading Genesis? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I would have not read Genesis if I had not been sent to an Anglican missionary school where I am told my undoing began. But anyhow, so where did the story come from? Well, the story came from the hadith literature, from six hadiths in particular that are found, three in Sahih al-Bukhari and three in Sahih Muslim. And again, for want of time, I would love to share with you all of these hadiths, but I will leave out a part of it. Each hadith, that is, each tradition that is attributed to the Prophet of Islam, is divided into two parts. The first part consists of isnad, which is a list of names of transmitters of that hadith, and the second consists of matn, the content. I will just read to you the content, which is very brief. Treat women nicely, for a woman is created from a rib, and the most curved portion of the rib is its upper portion. So if you should try to straighten it, it will break. But if you leave it as it is, it will remain crooked. So treat women nicely. Number two, the woman is like a rib. If you try to straighten her, she will break. So if you want to get benefit by her, do so while she still has some crookedness. Number three, whoever believes in Allah and the last day should not trouble his neighbor. And I advise you to take care of women, for they are created from a rib. And the most crooked part of the rib is its upper part. If you try to straighten it, it will break. And if you leave it, it will remain crooked. So I urge you to take care of women. These three are from Sahih al-Bukhari. Four, woman is like a rib. When you attempt to straighten it, you would break it. And if you leave her alone, you would benefit by her, and crookedness will remain in her. Number five, woman has been created from a rib and will in no way be straightened for you. So if you wish to benefit by her while crookedness remains in her. And if you attempt to straighten her, you will break her, and breaking her is divorcing her. Number six, he who believes in Allah and the hereafter, if he witnesses any matter, he should talk in good terms about it or keep quiet. Act kindly towards women, for woman is created from a rib, and the most crooked part of the rib is its top. If you attempt to straighten it, you would break it, and if you leave it, its crookedness will remain there. These are from Sahih Muslim. If I were to do content analysis, it would take a long time. Let me just point out a couple of things. Here, this is the rib story entering the Islamic tradition. I cannot give a date on it because no research has been done on it. But what's interesting is that even as the story is being co-opted into the Islamic tradition, it's changing. Because here you have the mention, there is no mention in any of these six hadiths of Adam. So this is now a disembodied rib. It could be anything's rib. This is a further dehumanization of woman. Secondly, there is the mention of crookedness in each of these hadiths. Now, how do you interpret that? Now, in terms of Islamic scholarship and in terms of belief system, if there is one Quranic statement which is clear, that holds, and not 1 million hadiths can supersede it or can overturn it. This is what all Muslims accept. And yet, this is a clear example where 30 creation stories which are totally egalitarian have been overturned by the hadith literature. This is a clear example of how it has happened. Now, from a scholarly point of view, you say, well, you reject the hadiths. But the hadiths have become so ingrained and they have penetrated Muslim culture so deeply that it is not simply a matter of rejecting hadith. Furthermore, hadith cannot be rejected according to Islamic scholarship, unless you prove that there are weaknesses in the isnad. Now, in my book and through my research, I show that these hadiths should be rejected also on accounts of weakness in the isnad. Now, the question arises, why did I do this research? You know, my friends who were activists in the street were getting a bit impatient with me. They were saying, here we are on the streets, we are being lathi charged, we are being put in jail and so on, and here you are talking about Adam and Eve. Get real. And I said to them, but you know, I am, this is very real. And I presented to them two separate ideas, which I would like to present to you for your consideration. One is, why I think the creation issue is so important. You see, if God created man and woman equal, which is the clear teaching of the Quran, if God created man and woman absolutely equal, then if they subsequently become unequal in human society, which they have virtually everywhere, this cannot be said to be the will of God. On the other hand, if God did not create men and women equal, which is what the majority of Muslims, Jews, Christians believe, then if you try to make them equal, as some of these perverse feminists are trying to do, that is against the will of God. So what you believe about creation is the most important and basic theological point here. Secondly, Santayana said, those who do not know their history are destined to repeat it. Okay? Another thought for you. A Quranic scholar once said to me, if you are traveling, if you're going somewhere on a train, and somehow the train gets off the track, it becomes derailed, and you start going in some other direction, and you realize after you've gone astray for 20 miles that you are not on the right track, you cannot at that point get back on track. What you have to do is you have to go back to the point at which you became derailed, and then you get back on track. My sisters, my contention is that women, all of us, we got derailed at the very start. And unless we go back to that point of derailment, we are not going to get back on track. And finally, I would like to say this. Why is this the strategy that I'm advocating? Why am I not supporting some other strategies? There are other people, there are many human women's rights activists and human rights activists, say for example in Pakistan, which is my country of origin, take the position that human rights and Islam are incompatible. If you want to work for women's liberation, you have to do it outside the framework of Islam. I disagree with that position, both personally on, as a matter of faith, but also on a very important pragmatic ground. And the ground is as follows. The average Muslim woman has three characteristics. There are 500 million Muslim women in the world. The characteristic of an average Muslim woman is three. She is poor, she's illiterate, and she lives in a village. Now, if I, as an activist, as a woman's right or human rights activist, want to liberate this woman, this Muslim woman who lives in any village from Ankara to Jakarta, how am I going to communicate with her? Can I go to her and say, I am bringing you liberation in the name of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights 1948? Is that going to make sense to her? It's not, because she doesn't understand what that is. It's not relevant to her life. But I can say to her, look, you believe in God. You believe in the justice of God. If you believe that the Quran is the word of God, which you do believe, the Quran cannot be then used as a means of perpetrating any kind of injustice. In fact, the Quran is a guarantor of all the fundamental human rights, if you read the Quran with an open point of view. Many analysts, including many analysts in the West and Western media, have done a tremendous job of Islam bashing and Muslim bashing, including the bashing of Muslim women. Case in point, Bosnian Muslim women's rape, the burning of Turkish girls in Germany, and so on. There's not enough time to dwell on all that aspect. But I just want to say the following. There are many people who are very disturbed by this sort of an approach. In the West particularly, and I've lived in the West for 31 years of my life, so I know this very well. If one is perceived as a woman, as a Muslim woman who is deviant, who is in defiance against her own tradition, you get a lot of support, and you get, you have the support on account of being perceived as the poor, oppressed Muslim women. What I have tried to share with you is that Muslim women undoubtedly have very serious problems in terms of gender inequity and so on. But my contention is that Muslim women, like African women, like Latin American women, like all the minority women, we must find the models of liberation within the framework of our belief system. The majority of the Muslims in the world, including Muslim women, and I'm talking about 95% and more, are believers, whatever their belief system might be, or however, whatever the details are. So that is, in order to understand Muslim women, in order to understand their plight, and in order to understand and help them develop some sort of a framework of liberation, one has to understand that in the context of the Islamic world, religion is not just a factor. It's not like the economic factor and the political factor and the social factor and the cultural factor. Religion is the matrix in which the lives of Muslims are rooted. So if you will not take the challenge of religion and feminist theology seriously, there is no other way of liberating Muslim women.
Rifat Hassan spoke on a panel about the rise of conservatism in Huairou, China, September 4th, 1995. Reporting for Wings, this is Mary O'Grady.
Rifat Hassan is a Pakistani-American theologian and scholar of the Quran. Her bio is in Wikipedia. Her name is spelled RIFFATHASSAN. I'm Frieda Worden. I recorded this talk in Huairou, China, at the 4th UN World Conference on Women in 1995. It's one of my favorites. Wings thanks all our supporters, including the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, USA Chapter, your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose events can be viewed on the website maternalgifteconomymovement.org. Serving community radio since 1986, we are the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The staff and volunteers at CJSF wish you a jolly, merry, happy, joyful, fantastic, exciting, fancy, magnificent, remarkable, special, white, sparkling, terrific, stunning, festive, and wonderful holiday season.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't. Nearly 1 in 4 people can't afford food in Canada. What does food insecurity look like where you live? Look up your address at foodsecuritynow.ca. That's foodsecuritynow.ca. Join Community Food Centers Canada in making a difference today.